Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. We're glad to have you here with us tonight. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from east of the Appalachian Mountains. Our AccuWindow forecast is clear skies, about 71 degrees. Should be a great stargazing night. The solar wind is 349 kilometers per second. Space Shuttle Discovery has undocked from the International Space Station in advance of a Monday morning landing at the Kennedy Space Center. Skywatcher should be alert for double flybys as the two spaceships circle Earth together. Interesting about that. On Monday morning, tomorrow, Space Shuttle Discovery will make a rare descending node overflight of the continental United States en route to landing in Florida. Many towns and cities in the country's heartland are near the ground track. So those of you across the central part of the nation going northwest to southeast might be able to see it crossing over in the early morning hours and might even hear a sonic boom. Landing is scheduled for 8:48 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And it takes the shuttle about 35 minutes to traverse the path across the United States, coast to coast, in 35 minutes. Observers in the northwestern USA will see the shuttle shortly after 5 a.m. Pacific Daylight Time, blazing like a meteoric fireball through the dawn sky. That should be cool. As Discovery makes its way east, it will enter daylight and fade into the bright blue background, so you can't see the shuttle. However, you might be able to hear it. The shuttle produces a sonic double boom that reaches the ground about a minute and a half after passing overhead. So you might want to be out tomorrow morning. It's supposed to land 8:48 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Remember, it only takes 35 minutes to cross the country, so you might want to step outside before going to work and see if you can catch that. The temperature in Vostok, Antarctica, you know, Vostok, where the under-ice lake was discovered by the Russians about two decades ago. Anyway, the temperature there is minus 103 degrees Fahrenheit with a wind chill of minus 147 degrees Fahrenheit. Motor oil freezes at that temperature. The station stopped reporting a few hours ago. We hope that they are equipped to handle these temperatures. I doubt there are any believers in global warming down there right now. Kind of like we were with record snows this year all over Northern Hemisphere. And by the way, glacier growth is up again this year all over the world. All glaciers are growing at a fairly good rate. My new book, Remembering the Future, is out as an ebook. The printed version will take about 76 more days, but you can read it now and get a 25% discount on the printed version by going to rememberingthefuturebook.com, rememberingthefuturebook.com. $7.95, you get to read it today with color photographs and color drawings. And then when it comes out in print, you get 25% off that version. You'll get an autographed copy you can set on the bookshelf already with a smile on your face from having read it. Also, Twitter is alive and well on X Squared Radio. I add stuff all day as we approach the announcement on the Inner Earth Expedition, the launch of the nation's first affordable electric vehicles, and other great things. So follow me on Twitter by searching for Brooks Agnew. Tonight, we're going to go ahead and open up the phone lines immediately. The phone number, if you want to be part of the program, is 415-762-1161. 415-762-1161. That works anywhere globally. If you can get to a cell phone tower on planet, off planet, it makes no difference. We would love to hear what you have to say on the subject that we're addressing tonight. Now, we have addressed this subject before on this program, but, you know, we've kind of touched on it with a guest here and a guest there, sort of unrelated materials on physics or cosmology or other some such. And we touch on the subject of reincarnation. So I would like to dedicate a program tonight to that. We will take your calls, your questions, and I'm going to share some information with you from Ian Lawton. We have contacted him and asked him to be part of the program. So he is going to be part of the program through his book, and we're going to read a little bit of that to you and sort of get the juices flowing and see if you can draw up some of those memories. We'll be back in 40 seconds. Don't go away. X Squared Radio is about to launch. The book is called The Little Book of the Soul. It's a little book you can read in about a couple of hours if you're a decent reader, an afternoon, a nice leisurely afternoon. Ought to do something for you because we're going to share a short story from it right now. Remember that our phone lines are open, 415-762-1161, if you want to be part of the program tonight. This short story is called The G.I. Joe Dolls, and it is a true story. From the earliest age, James Leninger of Lafayette, Louisiana, had been fascinated with aircraft. He spent hours playing with toy planes and always pointed and yelled when he saw a real aircraft in the sky. His parents, Bruce and Andrea, a well-educated and grounded couple, were both satisfied that this was just typical childhood behavior. Even when James became obsessed with crashing his toy planes into the living room table that served as his landing strip. But in the spring of 2000, as he approached his second birthday, vivid nightmares began. He would regularly thrash around in his sleep, especially kicking out with his legs up in the air, and it was the words he uttered while writhing that really shook his parents. Airplane crash, on fire, little man can't get out. They began to fear that his obsession might not be so harmless after all. Why on earth did he keep replaying the actions of a pilot desperately trying to kick out his cockpit window? It was at this point that Andrea's mother, having read a book about similar cases, suggested that these might be memories of a past life. Andrea contacted the author, Carol Bowman, and followed her suggestion that she and Bruce should take the nightmares seriously and discuss them with James. This did reduce their regularity, but as a result, James also started to come up with startling details, usually when being comforted after a nightmare. Over that summer and into the autumn, he revealed that the pilot of the plane was also called James, that he had been shot down by the Japanese, that he had flown Corsairs, and that one of his fellow pilots went by the name of Jack Larson. He also mysteriously mentioned this single word, Natoma. Bruce remained dubious about any sort of spiritual explanation, but his curiosity simply would not allow him to ignore the level of detail James was reporting. He knew that neither he nor any other member of their family had any particular interest in aircraft or the war, nor did he feel that the information could have come from such a young child who could not even read at this point, watching documentaries without anyone else being aware of it. So, still, with the primary intention of somehow proving that there was a perfectly rational explanation for James's memories, he began to research them. His first port of call was to search for the word Natoma on the Internet. This quickly established that an aircraft carrier called the USS Natoma Bay had been stationed in the Pacific during the latter part of World War II, and, among other things, had taken part in the notorious battle for the Japanese island of Iwo Jima early in 1945. Coincidentally, his book club catalog included one all about this battle, so he ordered it, even though, at this point, he still felt the whole thing was pure coincidence. But not long afterwards, he was really shell-shocked for the first time. One day, he was flicking through the book when James came over to sit on his lap, and it happened to be open at a map. Immediately, James pointed to the island of Chichijima to the north of Iwo Jima and said, "Daddy, that is where my plane was shot down." His interest now well and truly piqued, Bruce continued his internet search and came across a Natoma Bay Association, by which means he was able to contact a radio man who had been involved in the Iwo Jima conflict. And although he had reported that their squadron had flown only Avengers and Wildcats, not Corsairs, he did confirm that a Jack Larson had been one of the pilots. This was starting to look like more than just coincidence. For the next 18 months, Bruce searched military records trying to find out more details about Larson, but in vain. Indeed, he was close to giving up when he attended a reunion of the Natoma Bay Association in the autumn of 2002. Without disclosing his real interest, he was able to establish that Larson was not dead, and he, as he had assumed, but alive and living in Arkansas. Even more revealing, he found out that while a total of 21 men had been lost from the Natoma Bay during the campaign in the Pacific, only one pilot had been lost at Chichijima, and coincidentally, his name was Lieutenant James M. Houston, Jr. Aged only 21, he had volunteered to fly that one last mission on the 3rd of March, 1945, before he was due to return to the U.S. Bruce immediately arranged to visit Larson in Arkansas, and he confirmed he had been Houston's wingman that day. But neither he nor any other members of the squadron had actually seen what happened to Houston's plane in the heat of battle. Nevertheless, something else now slotted into place for the increasingly stunned Bruce. His son had always signed his drawings of aircraft, James III. Was this his way of recognizing that his former personality had been James Houston, Jr., and his father, in turn, James Houston, Sr.? At this point, the investigation switched to tracking down any surviving members of the deceased's family, and at the beginning of 2003, Bruce made contact with Houston's elder sister, Ann Barron, in California. Without telling her his true interest, they became friendly, and she kindly sent him a number of packages of photos of her long-departed brother. By this time, the only major statement that James had made that did not ring true was his insistence that his former personality had flown Corsairs. Bruce knew that Houston had been flying a Wildcat on that fateful day, and this gave him some sort of faint hope that James's memories might still turn out to be just coincidental. That was until he examined the photographs, because in amongst them was a clear shot of Houston standing proudly next to a Corsair. Bruce subsequently confirmed from military records that before he was posted to the Natoma Bay, Houston had been part of an elite special squadron of only 21 pilots, the Devil's Disciples, who test flew Corsairs for carrier use. At this point, he finally submitted to what his wife and others had long accepted, that his son James really was the reincarnation of a pilot who had died nearly 60 years before. But even this was not all, because James made a number of other detailed and obscure statements that turned out to be true. For example, he insisted that Corsairs often suffered with tire punctures, which was confirmed by an aircraft museum. He also said that his former personality's plane had been shot in the engine, which set it on fire before it hit the sea. And eventually, Bruce made contact with several members of a bomber squadron that had also been attacking Chichijima that day, who all confirmed that they had seen the engine on Houston's plane explode into flame. As if his detailed recall of names, places, and other obscure information were not enough, perhaps the most impressive part of James's recall related to three G.I. Joe dolls that he called Leon, Walter, and Billy. Again, military records confirmed that three of the pilots from Houston's squadron who had been killed in other Natoma Bay engagements were Lieutenant Leon S. Connor, Ensign Walter J. Devlin, and Ensign Billy R. Peeler. In fact, when James was asking why he named the dolls that way, he replied, "Because they greeted me when I went to heaven." The records also showed all three had died before Houston. In an entirely fitting conclusion, James is now once again in possession of two of his former personality's most treasured belongings, forwarded on by the military after Houston's death, and in turn by his sister Anne when she heard the rest of the story, a bust of George Washington and a model of a Corsair aircraft. 415-762-1161, if you'd like to be part of tonight's program. My question is, as we investigate, or at least talk about this subject of reincarnation, I realize that we cross the grass. We're not walking on the sidewalk here. We have many, shall we call them, religious friends, religious affiliates out there, with whom we have had long relationships, and about whom there is a strong level of faith. There is also a profound disbelief in the idea of reincarnation. We are open to other explanations, ideas that may explain away these many, many coincidences. And I have to admit, as I'd studied the subject matter over the years, I have kind of set aside the adult ones, because I am approached from time to time, and people say, well, in a past life, I, of course, was a high priest in Egypt and was responsible for helping to design the pyramid. No, you see, they're never like servers, or they're never oil boys, and they're never water bearers, or, you know, people that tend oxen. No, no, no. They're always a principal designer of this or that. And so I kind of set those aside because, after all, they're adults. And they could have read books. They could have seen History Channel specials. They could have sat around with experts at different times in their life and picked a detail up here and a detail up there and sort of pieced them all together. Intentionally, not intentionally, it's hard to say. But the kids are the tough ones to throw out, like James Houston here. The idea that He could have such detailed memories. A pre-kindergarten boy without the ability to read, not prone to long hours in front of Discovery Channel absorbing things. This is the kind of thing that really piques the curiosity. And it really says to me, I doubt very seriously that they're tapping into some other personality. I doubt they're being possessed. I doubt that they are anything less than what they say they are, that they are an experienced soul, experienced with another lifetime. And the memories, as they have just recently stepped through the veil, are still fresh, and they bring them forward with them. Now, oftentimes, the memories maybe don't come through so clearly, but the skills learned in previous lives do. And so if there are any listeners out there, any Earth explorers out there listening live to X-Squared Radio tonight, I'm going to ask the question, did you come into this life with some innate skill, some higher level skill, like being able to play concert piano or be able to compose complex poetry or be able to negotiate mathematics well beyond your grade level? Or a tremendous artistic ability, and especially the propensity to draw things that are not from here or not familiar to your surroundings, maybe another age, another time, or even another world. If you've grown up and you've got those memories in the past, or if you're a young person, sit down with your folks tonight and see if it's okay if you call into X Squared Radio and share your story. 415-762-1161. Now, we have great writers like Ian Lawton out there who have done lots of research. We have psychiatrists who have led the way into psychotic research. We have psychologists who have done years and years of hypnotherapy on people who not only have had nightmares, but have had premonitions. They've had deja vu experiences, or they've met someone in their life and they realize that they know that person well beyond what they normally should in a lifetime, and they need an explanation. They want to understand what's going on. You know, we live on a fairly religious planet. Of the almost 7 billion people that live on the Earth, about 3 billion of us, maybe a little more than that, are deeply involved in one kind of religion or another, maybe close to 4 billion now. The majority of which is Christianity. I know that strikes a lot of you as odd, but about 3.1 billion are Christian, and the next is Islam, and the next is Buddhist, and then Hindu, and then on into the smaller traditions. And as you go back and look at the traditions of what their creation story is, how the universe was formed, and what being a soul is all about, coming into this world, leaving this world, the various injustices and beauties that may be part of a lifetime, they have various explanations. Some of them are suitable and some of them are not. There's a common thread through all of these, even the ones that are not really religious traditions, shall we call them. In other words, you don't go to a regular meeting on Saturday or Sunday, and there's no pastor, and there's no scripture. But there's a common thread, and that common thread seems to be that the soul, the actual animating energy that makes the biological transducer we call the human body, move about and prefer things and desire things or feign other things. That part is eternal. That part lives forever and possibly has lived forever. The question is, has it lived forever as a wisp, an orb, a light, an energy, a sound, a thought? Or has it actually lived? Has it actually gone through innumerable skinned knees and broken hearts? Has it reached goals and fallen short? Has that soul gained experience lifetime after lifetime, perhaps getting better and better? Maybe through scripting or habits, fallen into a weakness that they find great difficulty in overcoming. These are questions that sometimes go unanswered with the traditional script, the traditional religion. But they are very well answered with the idea or the practice of reincarnation. And that's what we're discussing tonight. You can become part of the program by calling in 415-762-1161. We'll take all callers. If you want to support it, that's fine. If you want to say, I'm sorry, you only get one shot at life, you get, after you spit the last of your amniotic fluid out, the clock is ticking. Make your best, because you only get one. If you are that kind of proponent, then give us a call. We'll talk about it. Remember, everything that enters here goes into the function of X squared and comes out positive. Even negative thoughts will come out positive when squared. We invite you to join the program tonight. I'm going to read one more piece of Ian Lawton's The Little Book of the Soul. This one will, if it doesn't make you a believer, it will at least make you curious. Madhya Pradesh is a huge central state in India. It was here that Swarnalata Mishra was born in 1948, and she was only 3 years old when she began to reveal amazing details of another life. On this occasion, her father, an inspector of schools, had decided to take her on a trip from their home city of Panna in the north of the state to the central city of Jabalpur, some 170 miles to the south. On their return, they were less than a third of the way home when, on the outskirts of the city of Katni, Swarnalata asked the driver to turn down a road towards my house. Shortly afterwards, when they had stopped for a meal in Katni, she began insisting that they would obtain much better food in her house nearby. Of course, this puzzled her father, but it was not until some time later that he discovered she was continuing to talk about her previous life in Katni to her brothers and sisters. She said her name had been Biya Pathak. A number of years passed, during which time Swarnalata and her family moved some 40 miles west to the district of Chhatarpur, so that her father could take up a new post. Every now and then she would refer to her past life, but it was not until she was 10 years old that he started to take her more seriously. The breakthrough came when a local professor, having heard a vague rumor about Swarnalata's claims, invited her and her father to dinner. During the meal, Swarnalata learned that the professor's wife originally came from Katni and asked her to meet her. So Swarnalata's recognition of an old friend of Bia's was instant, and the lady herself was stunned when Swarnalata reminded her of how, in her former life, they had had difficulty in finding a toilet at a wedding in the village of Tilona. Could a child's vivid imagination alone really come up with such detailed imagination? Unlikely. Although this time it is not of a historical nature, once again it is not only verifiable but also highly obscure. And certainly the extent of information provided by Swarnalata seems to make guesswork statistically impossible, as we are about to see. For the first time, her father, now documenting the key statements she had made to date, included that Bia had had two sons, and that her family had owned a motor car, a rarity in this part of India, even in the 1950s. She especially recalled a number of details about her former home. Apparently, it was white on the outside, with black front doors fitted with iron bars for security. Inside, there were four decoratively plastered rooms, while others were less well finished, and the front of the house had stone floor slabs. Behind it lay a girls' school, while a railway line and lime furnaces were also nearby. Katni is well known as one of the largest railway junctions in India, and also for its lime deposits, so the last two statements might be regarded as easy guesses, if Swarnlata were making it all up. But what about the other less obvious details? Not long after the incident, at the professor's house, the leading Indian paranormal researcher, Hemendra Banerjee, learned of the case, and he spent 2 days with Swarnlata and her family in their home in Chhatarpur. He was so impressed that he made up his mind to go to Katni to try to locate her former family. But he knew that Pathak was an extremely common name in the region, so he would only have her statements about her former home to guide him. Nevertheless, in time, he was able to find a house that matched the external description in the right location, near to a school, railway, and lime furnaces. And the family who owned the house was well known in the Katni Jabalpur area for their extensive business interests, and were indeed called Pathak. So far, so good. But in his wildest dreams, Banerjee could not have expected to find that they did indeed have a deceased daughter called Biya. After her marriage, she had moved to Maiha, a town some 40 miles to the north, where she and her husband had raised two sons. But unfortunately, she had died in 1939 from heart disease. This alone ought to be enough to convince most skeptics, but in fact it was only the beginning of an even more extraordinary case. In that same summer of 1959, several members of Bia's family had decided to visit Chhatarpur to test Swarnlata out. First, her eldest brother arrived unannounced at the Mishra family home, but Swarnlata quickly recognized him and called him by the nickname Biya had used, Babu. Then, in conjunction with Swarnlata's father, Biya's widowed husband and one of her sons arranged a meeting in which they were anonymously present among 9 other local men. Not only did Swarnlata identify them both, but she did so despite Biya's son trying to throw her off the scent for a full 24 hours. He insisted that he was someone else, and that a friend he had brought along was Bia's other son. But on both counts, Swarnlata stuck to her guns quite correctly. Not long afterwards, Swarnlata traveled to Katni to visit her former home for the first time. Here, she correctly identified a number of people without any leading, and even again, with a certain amount of deliberate misleading. These included Bia's other 3 brothers and various other relations, a Pathak family servant, the family cowherd, refusing to be put off by the claims that she was wrong because he was dead, and a former family friend and his wife, commenting on his spectacles, which he had not worn when Bia was alive. She also asked about a neem tree in the compound and a parapet at the back of the house, both of which had been there in Bia's time, but were now missing. Further visits to Katni and Maihar followed, in which more people were recognized and statements were verified, up to a total of nearly 50 in all. But perhaps the most compelling piece of evidence came from Swarnlata confiding to her former husband that he had taken 1,200 rupees from Bia's money box. This was something of an embarrassment that he confirmed had not been known except to himself and his former wife. Faced with such overwhelming evidence, it was not long before all parties fully accepted the reality that Swarnlata was Bia reincarnate. Indeed, she continued to visit her former family regularly, and their close bonds were reestablished. What amazed onlookers was the way that in the company of her former brothers she would adopt the attitude of an older sister. And they, in turn, seem to accept this as perfectly reasonable, despite the fact that in this life, she was their junior by some 40 years. Our phone number tonight, 415-762-1161. 415-762-1161. We're covering the subject of reincarnation tonight. I want to bring to the forefront the idea that we're not trying to make you a believer in a reincarnation. We're only putting the question out there. What we want you to do is think about it for a little while. See if you have any ideas that may have come to you of late, or that you've thought about, questions you might have had, even if it's, you know, in conflict with those things that you might have learned with your particular religious tradition. That's okay. I don't mind even discussing those. If you want to go into scripture, if you can find me some scriptural support for the idea that there's no such thing as reincarnation, I'll entertain it. Everything's on the table tonight. We just want you to think about it for a moment. We'll take about a 3-minute musical breather here while I drink some cold refreshment and ease my voice a little bit. You can go ahead and dial in and be standing by. 415-762-1161. Phone lines open all night. And don't forget the book, Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, is now available as an ebook at rememberingthefuturebook.com. Rememberingthefuturebook.com. If you can't remember all of that, go to xsquaredradio.com. The book cover, or the proposed book cover, is on the website there. Click that. It'll take you to the website. You will get a 25% discount on the printed version, which is due out in about 76 days. And it will come autographed. So that is a pretty good value, $7.95. Almost all of it goes to the purchase of the printed version, which will come autographed as soon as you place your order. We will send you a 25% off coupon code, because when you buy the book, it will provide your email to us, and we will send that to you. So take a breather for about 3 minutes. Let me drink something cold. We'll be right back. Listen to a little Hymn of the Cherubim by Tchaikovsky. Thank you. high up in the lands of Iceland, there has been an eruption the last couple of days. Volcanic ash, 7 kilometers up. You can see the trail of ash around the planet from space. It has cut off most of Europe as the strange winds carry the ash high altitude down into Scotland and the UK, making transarctic flights almost impossible. Flying a jet through these would be catastrophic. The ash would chew the bearings of the jet engine up in short order. Only 5,000 flights today out of Europe, normally 22,000 in a single day. So it's having its economic impact upon our lives as well. And something else that's occurring, lightning in the clouds above the Arctic. We do understand that volcanic eruptions produce strong lightning. Less well known is why. Ordinary lightning in thunderstorms is not fully understood. Volcanic lightning is even more of a mystery. To investigate, a team of researchers from New Mexico Tech has traveled to Iceland to monitor the Icelandic volcano, and they have found it crackling with electricity. Of course, being very close to the strong magnetic flux coming out of the center of the Earth may exacerbate things. Tonight we're talking about reincarnation. We have opened the phone lines. Our first caller tonight on line one, welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Agnew. I have a question to ask you about this. There's been a lot of work done on near-death experiences, and I know that's not reincarnation per se, but it does kind of validate that there is an area where somebody has gone, and they, in a sense, they have been reincarnated because they came back. I mean, these kind of people were clinically dead, diagnosed, and granted, they came back into their own life, but within some of those experiences, they've also recalled other lives. So do you think that studies on near-death experiences help to validate reincarnation, or is that a separate?
Well, I think they could. I mean, at least what it does, it opens the idea that there is a soul part to the body. You know, we had Dr. Gary Schwartz on his program about a year ago, and we had discussed his book, The God Experiment, and they had done a number of studies with well-known mediums, one of whom was John Edwards. And John Edwards had really, really beaten the statistics beyond any of the double-blind studies' ability to call it anything relating to trickery. I mean, this was just really, really bona fide stuff. However, the interesting thing was it only went back to that generation. In other words, it was Grandpa Jones or it was, you know, Auntie L. But, you know, there wasn't anything that opened up past that one life. And Dr. Schwartz found that interesting as well. What I do find different is that the near-death experiences where the person leaves the body for a while, takes a journey to what seems to be a pretty common arrival place for most people going through this experience, no matter who they are, they return with a very clear picture of not only the eternality of the soul, but how they have impacted other lifetimes by living them. They bring previous experiences with them, and they bring the experience from the near-death experience as well, back into the original living body that they just left. So I think it supports it. What do you think?
Yeah, I was thinking, I've read some of those studies where they've gone and they have done like these reviews, and some of these reviews include previous past lives, if you know. to see have they been learning the what they've wanted to learn. You know, have they stayed on task and not repeated certain things, or you know, not recycled, but are they, you know, getting the information that they need to get to grow and develop.
That's a good point. I mean, let's cover that about recycling. You know, a lot of people think that, oh, gee, you know, Earth is hell, and when you die, if you weren't good enough to go to heaven, you're going to be sent right back here for another hellish life. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think Earth life, mortal life, is hell?
I think hell is where you want to find it and what you want to make it. I think it pretty much is comes to what you believe. I think for people, anything they believe to be true, it's truly true for them. And whether you can see it as an outsider, you can stand back and look, they can't see the forest for the trees. So their belief makes it real for them. And if they believe they're victims, they live a victim life. It's that kind of thing. If they believe they're going to be successful and they can do this, it seems that they are also able to operate on that and be extremely successful. So that's my answer to that. But I did want to ask you another one. They've done Raymond Moody. He was a physician, and he worked with children years and years ago. He's written a few books on life after life experiences, but he also he was working with Stevenson, who was a researcher and a doctor, and I can't remember what university he was at, where they were actually going into and researching cases of reincarnation and documenting them. And they were doing this documentation. There was quite a few, actually, that were starting to do this, along with a gentleman called Michael Newton. And they were documenting these cases of reincarnation. Children, especially, were very interesting to do because they were the most unlikely to know information that they were bringing in. But he amassed an amazing amount of information, along with a lot of other researchers in the late 70s and early 80s. And this is before the Internet was really up and running. And so the people they were studying didn't have access to the kind of information you would do now. So those research projects actually are really validate, in a lot of ways for me, the reincarnation aspect of that. That's probably a very viable experience that we have, or way that we move through this life. And I don't know, do you think that based on that, because these studies were done not now, but there was a lot of these that are being brought together now, a lot of that information is being brought forward together, do you think that gives it more validity?
Well, as I said at the opening of the program, I have a tendency to kind of perhaps obfuscate the adult testimonies, because, you know, even though we didn't have internet, there are libraries, and there were, you know, programs on television about reincarnation, and people, you know, can have, you know, their own thoughts about it, and even their own imagination can concoct something over time. But I really am fascinated by the children ones. I'll tell you one that kind of hits home. I had a friend in Indiana whose name was Larry, and moving there, he became, he fell in love with a woman who was going through a rather rough divorce, and that complete, she had a young boy about 1 year old, and he really didn't know why, you know, he was so attracted to her, although, you know, of course, she's beautiful. But one of the things that that he found so strange is that when he was young, he had had these experiences that he calls being abducted by aliens. And at a certain point in his life, I guess he just achieved his manhood and basically fought them off and said, no more, you're not going to take me anymore. And so they left him alone, or so he supposed, maybe. They did. But anyway, getting to know her and meeting her in the cafeteria from time to time as their relationship progressed, he divulge this to her, just in brief, you know, hey, I, you know, had these experiences when I was young, and her eyes lit up, and she said, oh, I know exactly what you're talking about. And she took her forefinger and touched it to her forehead and went, like that. Well, that immediately just, you know, shocked Larry, because that's exactly the way they used to take him. They would come in the room, and they had this kind of a short chrome pointer with a round end, and they would just simply touch him on the forehead, and you feel a mild electric shock, and he just went catatonic. And then they would, go up into sinuses and things like that. Anyway, it wasn't too horrible, but he said they were repairing something. Anyway, how this relates to reincarnation is this synergy between these two developed to the point where they did get married, and now he has the responsibility of raising that young boy. Well, the boy's about 3 and a half, about 2 and a half years or so after they get married. The young boy's getting out of the tub, and Larry's throwing a towel around him and, you know, rubbing his hair and stuff like that. You know how kids can get kind of goofy coming out of the tub. And all of a sudden, the boy just looked him straight in the eye and said, do you remember when I was your daddy and I used to give you rides on the big red tractor? And that's exactly what his father used to do.
Wow, what do you think of that?
Well, I could tell you, it sent him 50 rows back, because as if he didn't already have a strangeness in his life being an abductee, he now had this reincarnation experience with a young boy that he was not the father to, but came into his life as a stepfather. But the fact that this boy just, like, all of a sudden just kind of stepped forward and looked him straight in the eye, like this thought just came to him. He's 3 and a half, for crying out loud. It's not like, you know, he took it from some novel that he's read. And that's the kind of stuff that really rings true for me. That's the kind of stuff that you can't fake. You can't make that up.
Well, what do you think about the doctors who do, and these are, you know, psychiatrists and that, who do hypnosis, and they actually do take their patients into a past life in order to solve a problem, because they go through their life and they can't see any kind of evidence of why these patients are chronically feeling pains, where they go to the doctors and they said there's nothing wrong, or they're anxious or they're full of anxiety and there's really nothing in their life that has brought them to this point, no experiences, traumatic experiences. So they find a lot of success taking their patients through hypnotherapy, and then they regress them into a past life. Within that, they usually try to get them back to a point where they had an event or the experience that may have contributed to this or did contribute to it. Once they go through that, the patient then is, you know, comes out of hypnotherapy, and they don't suffer these problems anymore. They're gone. You know, the anxiety.
In other words, once they've gone back in hypnosis to sort of come to terms with whatever happened in the previous life, whether it's an accident or an act of war or disease or something, then it's sort of cleared from their current memory, and the pain memory or the illness memory that they have is then released.
So you think that may have some validity in contributing to the thesis that there is such a thing as reincarnation?
Well, I think so. I'm not really a big analyzer of hypnosis. I don't know any hypnotherapists, and if I've met them, the other habits in their life have precluded me making any kind of technical investigation into what they're doing. So I'm a skeptic, because I really like quantitative or direct observational information. When, as I said, an adult can, a variety of things can happen. They could be tapping into the Akashic record. They could be making it up. They could be fabricating it. They could be part of their imagination. And I don't really understand the process of hypnosis. It's not that I don't believe in it. I've certainly seen demonstrations on TV when people have been made stiff as a board and between two chairs, and a guy stands on top of them, and it doesn't even look like their body's depressing, let alone that they are, you know, have a board or some kind of glass or some kind of wires supporting them. It is really amazing. Now, I'm not saying that I believe in the ones that get up and, you know, cluck like a chicken or think that an onion is chocolate or any of that stuff. I could just tell you that for some people, hypnosis is very real, and for other people, there's open skepticism. Put me in the skeptic crowd. If it wasn't for the hypnosis, okay, I probably would believe it.
Okay, well, what about people who meet for the first time, but they have such an affinity towards each other? I mean, they feel like they've known each other before. They can't put their finger on it, but, you know, they just relax right into the relationship. They're very comfortable with each other right off the bat. Do you think that may give some credence to the theory of reincarnation? Do you think that has something to do with reincarnation?
Yeah, I do. And I think, in my personal opinion, I don't have a lot of factual data, but in my personal opinion, that doesn't necessarily mean it's restricted to Earth. We have reportedly a lot of people coming to Earth now that are known as starseed. They're known as star children. They're known as beings who have lived multiple lives on other worlds and have come here for the first time. And so they're bringing skill sets and a sense of balance and a sense of purpose and a different biological transducer with which to interpret the universe than what they're used to. And so they come into the world a little clumsy, a little hyperactive, a little held down by the gravity of this world. And I certainly see lots of evidence of that. So the idea that we meet somewhere 10,000, 100,000, a million years ago on this planet, on other planets, and then come here and recognize each other right away, I absolutely think that happens.
Okay, well, do you think that reincarnation conflicts with the belief in God?
Well, that's a good question. I guess one would have to say, and I'm just doing this purely from a talk radio host standpoint, I would rather have a clear definition of what God is, and then I could make a better decision on what on whether reincarnation conflicts with the belief in God. I think...
Okay, well, as far as the Christian religion goes, their belief in God and the way he is present.
So we're talking about the all-merciful, all-loving, omniscient God, the Father of Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think that it conflicts with it. Because if you read in the book of Genesis, by the time you get halfway through the book, you've already met five races, and none of them are from here. Adam was made from the dirt of the earth, and then life was breathed into him from somewhere. And then Eve was cloned from him and brought back to Earth as a fully grown adult, or maybe a young adult, obviously gestated, born, and raised somewhere else, and then brought here. And then the idea that, you know, guys like Philip are teleporting from place to place, and then the idea that God is all merciful, and you wonder about the lifetimes, the broad spectrum of lifetimes that we see on this earth, whether you're born in Bangladesh and, you know, barely given enough water to keep a mouse alive, and you die at the age of six of starvation and parasitic weakening. Or whether you're born in 1925 as a Jew in Germany and you're imprisoned at the age of 16 and die at the age of 17 in a prisoner of war camp, or whether you're born in the lap of luxury, never having to go a single day in your whole life without a bath or without three specially prepared meals of the best for you, the finest clothing and the best educational opportunities. To look at the spectrum of mortality on this planet and to say in true Christian fashion that God is in control of everything, then I would say it isn't fair. I would say that the six-year-old Bangladesh girl needs another lifetime. I would say that the individual born in the lap of luxury definitely needs another lifetime, this time with a hammer and a saw in his hands. I would say that those that lived as a victim in this life be given the chance to come back and live a decent life of bounty, to be able to create life in their own image, to be able to experience love and old age and grandchildren and Christmases. That is totally in line, completely in line with a God who would wish the highest and greatest development for all of his children.
Okay, I've got a two-part question. There's people who meditate and they get into certain meditative states of being and they're able to accomplish amazing experiences with those. Sometimes OBEs, or they just get information that they can utilize in their life the next day. They become a little bit more transformed, and they're better capable or able to move through their life. The other thing is that when you have you're under hypnosis, they're actually taking you to kind of a hypnotic, a meditative state. It's the same alpha state of being that you get to in meditation and or prayer too. People can do it with prayer. So it releases, you know, you into from this body, I guess. It relaxes you away from it so that you can access that different state of being. Are there any studies in science on when you get the brain to a certain alpha state or beta state that people experience more spiritual states of being and actually are tapping into something that's valid?
Well, that's a really good question, and I realize that I have spoken over the hour. So we will take a very quick 4-minute, 35-second break. If you want to hang through the break, you can. I'll take a quick break, 4 minutes, and be right back. Give our affiliates a chance to catch up and change tapes here. So hold on. We'll be right back with more X Squared Radio. Don't go away. Very interesting stuff on reincarnation. We'll be right back with more X Squared Radio. you're tuned in live with us tonight, we appreciate you so much. This is X Squared Radio. You're listening to the unfolding Lisa Gerard of her Duality album. Highly recommend her music. Very, very inspirational. Kind of fitting for tonight's subject matter. By the way, Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel is now out as an ebook. In about 76 days, it'll be out in print. You'll get 25% off the printed version and the autograph. If you buy the ebook, get a chance to read it now and begin to master the information inside the book before you get your printed version. And also on the 13th through the 17th of May, we will be at Questers in Calgary, Canada, questers.ca. Or you can click on the Questers link at X Squared Radio and find out more about it if you're in the Calgary area, or if you want to escape the global warming of the Midwest or the South, catch a flight up to Calgary where it'll be a little cooler, a little longer. We'd love to see you up there. We'll be talking on the physics of the soul and time travel up there, along with other keynote high-end speakers. Our phone number tonight, 415-762-1161. We have a caller still on line one, and we were addressing a subject of reincarnation. I'll ask her to restate the question. Are you still there, caller?
Yeah, I'm still here. now I've got to remember the question, right? I had so many of them.
Oh, that's your responsibility.
Well, it was talking about, let me ask this one instead. It might be better. There are so many different religions, you know, in past and manuscripts documenting this that go back, millennia. And we're talking about Hindus, Buddhists, just like you were saying earlier. And these, you know, even the Egyptian religion, you know, goes into, obviously, some reincarnation, too. So there's a lot of validity, you know, for it before the Christian religion came along. And then there, the Gnostics, you know, did have some reincarnation in there. Some of these, you know, like the Bible chose certain books to put in and other books not to. And funny enough, the ones they chose not to put in them involved reincarnation and addressed it. In the, but what I found is, usually you can't get all the information out of the Bible. There's usually a little passage here or there that just totally throws you off, and you go, how did they forget to edit this? And there's, I think, a passage in the Bible that does infer reincarnation. And I'm not sure if it's a quote from Jesus or Paul that did it. But do you think that the fact that we do have other information like this, manuscripts and that, that do validate it, that do refer to it extensively.
I know that there's a couple of passages that deal with resurrection. I know, and during the time of the writing of the New Testament, there were a couple of political bodies there. You had the Pharisees and the Sadducees. One body believed in reincarnation, and the other one didn't, and they seem to work together, you know, in their quest to, remove the Romans from ruling their lands. But it didn't really make it clear about reincarnation. Now, the one thing that Jesus did is he talked about acts of his Father, and he did say, "I do nothing save, I have not already seen the Father do it." Now, that would mean that he was around at the time the Father was doing whatever he was doing. Does that mean that Jesus is older than his Father or that he's the same age as his Father? Perhaps not, but it does tend to support the idea that there were at least multiple lifetimes in which they got to observe one another. Also in the first chapter of Jeremiah, where Jeremiah doubts his qualifications as a prophet and begins to speak that way toward God, and God comes back to him. This is the God of the Old Testament. And he says, before I formed thee in the belly, I knew thee and ordained thee to be a prophet. Well, that either means that Jeremiah existed as this spirit being who more or less resembled his earthly being, and he was ordained to be a prophet there, although I would say it's a little odd that there would be need for a prophet in a land where God lives, because prophets are only needed as mouthpieces for God in a mortal existence. So it would make sense that Jeremiah actually was alive in a mortal existence and was ordained to be a prophet in a previous lifetime. And there's just little things like that in the scriptures.
So is it, do you think the reason that Christian religions, don't believe in it is because they don't have the information, they're just not given it?
No. I definitely think it's the actions of religionists who have said, look, you only get one shot at this. And by the way, if you're going to make it, you better keep coming to church. And don't forget to put a few dollars in the hat as it goes down the aisle there. We can't keep the lights on without a little money. And I hate to bring it down to economics, but, when it comes to business, people, just follow the money. Come on. Use your mind. Use your intellect with which you were born. Look at it. Century, century, millennia after millennia, it is the power of the church. Of course, now it's the power of the bank. The bank has the money, Banks are sort of built like churches. You walk inside. Shh. There's money here. You be reverent now. You're in the bank. Time to be quiet. Don't step out of line or they might not loan you money. Anyway, just to give you the idea in your mind and to answer your question more clearly, I absolutely do not think it was God that removed it from the scriptures. I think it was governments and the desire of men to control other men and to subjugate other people. Take away the freedom and make them believe that not only do they only get one lifetime, but they better live it right or they're going to live in eternity in continual burning without ever being consumed. You don't want to go through that, do you?
No, yeah, right. Well, I would like you to do me a favor. I'm going to have to get off the phone here now. I don't want to type the line forever. But can you give me, in your opinion, or why you think that reincarnation would be something to take a good look at as and bring it into your own life as part of a philosophy?
Got to be like looking out at stars and saying we're alone in the universe. If we are, it's an awful waste of space. If we only get one lifetime, my gosh, what a tragedy it is. Look at all the tens of millions of babies that never even got to breathe air because their mothers killed them in the womb. I mean, of course, reincarnation has to be part of the growth of a soul. It must be.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate you taking the time with me tonight.
No problem. Thank you for the call. Our number tonight is 415-762-1161, 415-762-1161. I know it's springtime. I know the weather is pretty good coast to coast right now. And I know our listenership is kind of light, but those of you that are out there, if you want to call in and talk about this subject, if you know something about it, I'd really appreciate it if you've made any recent discoveries or have any experiences of your own, something of a past life that you may remember. We'd like to hear about it. A little bit more of Ian Lawton as we cruise into the second half of the second hour of X Squared Radio. Amélie de Chaville was the daughter of a wealthy French merchant. They owned a chateau to the northwest of the market town of Flers in Normandy. She grew up alongside her brother Philippe, their every whim attended to by servants, watching with amazement and envy as the beautifully dressed guests arrived for an endless procession of lavish balls. Often these were held by the lake and the grounds of the estate, and minstrels played on as the guests danced long into the night. But the carefree days of youth could not last forever. Before long, she found herself marrying an army officer and leaving the family home to move to a house on the Rue Saint-Georges in Paris. She was still comfortably off with servants of her own, but life was not quite as lavish as it had been with her father. She had two children, Edouard and Marianne. As time went on, life became increasingly difficult. The pressure for revolution was building as the gulf between rich and poor widened. Amélie decided to send her children, by now in their mid-teens, to the chateau for their safety. She rarely left the security of her home to venture into the streets of Paris, and when she did, she found the streets filthy and overwhelmed by rats. Then came the fateful day when she was dragged from her house by the mob and thrown into a small dark cell, nor was it long before she found herself being forced into a cart. Her hair had been cut short at the back, and she knew what was to come. But first she had to face the crowd on the journey to the square, and their hatred left her numb with fear. She watched as the victims ahead of her met their fate. So great was the bloodlust of the crowd that as soon as one head had fallen, they were ready for the next. Every available vantage point was taken, every window and balcony, like some great sporting occasion. The heads were trophies to be stuck on spikes, while the bodies were flung over a wall and left to rot. The streets were literally rivers of blood. Finally, Amélie's turn came. She stumbled up the steps to the guillotine, confused, petrified, jostled and pulled from all sides. Her hands were tied behind her back, and she was pushed down into position. Her throat struck the block so hard she nearly choked. Then, staring into the basket, with everything covered in a thick blanket of glistening blood, she heard the final swish. Little did she know that 200 years later, she would be back in France, searching for traces of that life. This was the most detailed of a number of lives that Cynthia Henderson described to Ramstar while in trance in Australia over the course of a number of sessions. It was enough to convince him to take her to France to see if they could find her former home, but it was a big risk, because none of them had ever been there before, at least not in this life. However, they would be aided by a young French Catholic with little sympathy for reincarnation, called Antoine in Le Breton, who would act as the independent witness. Starting from the bustling marketplace in Flers, they followed the route she had described in trance. You go past the church for a while, and then you come to a road, a big road, that goes between Rouen and Saint-Michel. Go right there for about an hour by coach, and then it starts to go up after you leave Paris, or Flers. The road goes over the top of a hill. You can look down. Mainly on the left side, you can see woods, trees, and fields. Then you turn left down to the chateau. Coming out of the town past the church and finding the main road north was no great problem, and before long they came to a long incline. At the top there was a spectacular view over a wooded valley on the left, and at the bottom a turning to the left, all just as Cynthia had described. The smaller road wound around for a while, and then disaster. A new estate had been built, and the roads had changed completely. They could not go in the direction she wanted. So, was this to be the end? Fortunately, after asking for directions, they were able to pick up the original road on the other side of the estate, and before long she pointed excitedly to a long and running alongside the road. She was convinced it belonged to the chateau, this wall, and that the entrance lay just ahead. As they drove into what was now a public park and slowly made their way up the tree-lined driveway, Cynthia's tension mounted. Oh, my God. I can't look. Oh, God. There it is. It's a tower. Previously, it had been a tantalizing dream, but now it was a reality, and the emotion was too much. Cynthia began to sob deeply. She at least felt she had come home. The chateau was a derelict ruin now after suffering bomb damage during the war, but it was not difficult to imagine its former splendor. Two stories high and crafted from cut sandstone blocks, the large porch with huge doors and long windows on each side, the imposing tower at the rear that she and her brother had been forbidden to climb, the lake nearby, all was exactly as she had described it in trance. Once she had had time to get over the initial shock, they walked around, and she soon found everything flooding back to her. I feel fantastic here. I feel as if I belong. It's incredible. I recognize everywhere. I have all these images of the coaches and the clothes and the people and the servants and the parties and everything. The whole bit. It's only just now that the impact has hit me. How real those people were. And this was my life. It's all so real to me. It's sort of like a big tunnel being opened up and my whole memory being brought back. The team then took her to Paris to see if they could locate her house there. This time, she could not lead them from the outskirts because the environment had changed beyond recognition. But when they arrived at the Rue Saint-Georges, she knew where to look. Unfortunately, the building at the site of her former home was completely different. And given her unpleasant memories of this latter part of her life, which were in such stark contrast to those of the chateau, the team agreed not to linger. Nevertheless, they had rather more success in tracing a regular holiday destination she had described as being within a few miles of the picturesque Mont Saint-Michel, on the coast some 50 miles to the west of Flers. This was a large country house, and she had said been owned by a friend of Amelie's father. As the team left the car park at Mont Saint-Michel, they were once again relying on the clarity of Cynthia's recall, and this time she had said little about the journey in trance, so they were instead relying on her recognizing the route consciously as they went along. But they need not have worried, because the country roads had not changed too much, and she retraced her steps as if it had only been yesterday. She directed them to a number of turns without making a single mistake. Then she told them they were approaching a stream, and that their goal was coming up on the right, just around a bend, which it was. Again, emotion got the better of her, and she burst into tears. Cynthia had described the house itself back in Australia. The details were borne out when they pulled into the courtyard of a U-shaped mansion with a central archway through which coaches would once have passed. The only difference was that a well lay in the center of the courtyard rather than the fountain she had described, but even this could have been the one feature to have changed significantly in the intervening centuries. As the team walked around, Cynthia again felt her surroundings coming to life. She was particularly captivated by the chapel in the grounds of the house, which she had also described previously. Apart from many other details that could perhaps be put down to intelligent guesswork, she had reported that it had a hexagonal stone font on the left, dark wooden pews, and, even more obscure, diamond-shaped blue-gray tiles on the floor. And when the team obtained permission to enter the chapel, yet again, all these details proved to be accurate. This was the initially skeptical Le Breton's reaction. Quote, It is difficult to work it out. It is a fascinating and intriguing experiment. It has reached the limit of credibility. It's absolutely different. I can't understand it. There is something spiritual at the heart of it. Close quote. Remember, too, that all of these events were documented on film by Ramstar and his team. In fact, they had already investigated another case that was equally, if not more impressive, in England. How about that? So, our phone number is 415-762-1161. We're discussing reincarnation. We have been reading a few true accounts that were recorded in the book, The Little Book of the Soul, by Ian Lawton. In recent conversations with him, he is not doing interviews anymore, but his books are out there, and he encourages us to talk about them. And I encourage you to buy a copy of it. It's just a little book. You can pick it up probably in any Barnes and Noble store or Borders store or local bookstore. The Little Book of the Soul. My question to you tonight is, do you have any reincarnation experiences of your own? Perhaps they are of duties or activities that you had in previous lifetimes on this planet, and maybe even possibly existence on other worlds. Have you had propensities to speak other languages or to dream in other languages? Have you been born with an ability beyond your years? In other words, when you were very young, did you have a natural ability to play the piano or to draw or to work mathematics or with mechanical abilities? You know, we all have different things that we like and dislike when we come into them. And I don't mean broccoli and raw tomatoes. I mean, there's music that we like. There are activities that we like. There are general areas of expertise to which we're instantly drawn. As you leave high school and go into college and you're exposed to a broader range of subjects in greater detail, we often find that our majors change because we start out as intending to be a lawyer and we end up being an English teacher. Or we start out majoring in biology or chemistry and end up in linguistics. Something along the way, some teacher, some subject matter, some book that we pick up, or a piece of music that we hear, or a remarkable scientific relationship stimulates us, inspires us, and we take off in a different direction. My question is, what's the source of the inspiration for you? What's the synergy? What's the click? What's the thing that really makes it happen for you, that idea that you're going to get joy out of learning something, out of knowing something, out of mastering something? That is innate to your being. And it may go with a family trait, and more often, it does not. More often, we come in as guests into the families into which we're born. We find friends as we travel the state, the country, the world. We meet souls with whom we have a long-lasting affinity, a history, as it were, that goes beyond words, beyond years, beyond reason of any recent mortality. No, it has to go beyond that. It has to go beyond the dimensions of life into other dimensions and other times. And then this opens a range of questions of logic. For instance, you know, how many times are we reincarnated on this world and why? And once we're reincarnated to the point, okay, I get it, I got it, I've overcome everything now. What do I do now? It says in the scriptures, I believe it's in the second chapter of Revelations, that if you overcome all, you can return to heaven as a pillar of heaven. To go no more out. That's what it says. And it's written in other scriptures, in other churches, other traditions. These same words are there. What could this possibly mean? That there are many times that you did go out again? You returned home for comfort, for salve, for counseling for rest, and then you turned around 40 years, 200 years, 1,000 years later, and you went out again. And the idea that perhaps you don't have to go out, but you want to go out. Maybe you want to have another life experience. Maybe you think you can remember enough and recall enough that you can bring those skills to a high level of proficiency early in life instead of very late in life when you could do nothing about it. That maybe, unlike Leonardo da Vinci, who obviously had skills and memories way beyond his ordinary lifetime and completely out of sync with the period of time in which he lived, he certainly never built any submarines or airplanes or spacecraft or moonships, but those things did exist, and the aircraft did fly, even though people in those days said heavier than air flight. Not only is it impossible, but it must be forbidden by God, because if man was meant to fly, well, you know the rest of the story. But perhaps he brought those memories from another time, in another world, where they flew on a regular basis like birds. And although Melvin Murrell in Morristown, Tennessee, was the first to glide his plane over the hills of eastern Tennessee, it was Wilbur and Orville and their struggle to get that plane off the ground on the sands of Kitty Hawk. By the way, it wasn't the struggle of building the airplane that slowed them down, and I believe it wasn't the struggle of building the airplane that gave them the determination to finish. No, no. It was the struggle to build the engine. Even though there were other gasoline and diesel engines available at the time, these two bicycle mechanics decided to master the ability of casting iron and making their own engine so that they could make the plane fly. I believe it is the challenges they overcame, hundreds and hundreds of sand castings and constructions, to get that motor to run and stay together without flying apart on the bench. It was that struggle that gave them the determination to get that plane in the air. And a lot of people don't realize what it was like that day. The wind blowing 20 to 25 miles an hour off the water. The rails that they had painstakingly laid out in the sand so that the plane, not having wheels and certainly not able to roll in the beach sand of Kitty Hawk, would slide down the rails and gain enough airspeed over the wings so that Bernoulli's principle could take hold and the wings would thereby lift the craft off the ground. And that's exactly what happened. They started up the engine and the engine ran, and they released it, running alongside of it as fast as they could to stabilize the wings. And when they released them, sure enough, the combination of the thrust of the handmade propellers and the headwinds into which they flew was enough to get that craft off the ground. Barely 150 feet he was in the air. Can you imagine the exhilaration as he left the ground and felt that he was slicing his way through the molecules of air that blew across that water? But there was something missing. There was something missing from that airplane, which is why that flight only lasted a few short seconds. I'll tell you that. As he took off the ground, the elevators were working fine. The rudders were working great. But there was no ailerons on the plane. No way to tilt the wings from left to right. And as he realized that the plane was beginning to wing over, that is to say, one of the wings was getting closer to the ground than the other one, his natural tendency was to turn into that with the rudder to try, as they would on a bicycle, to turn into it to get the balance back. He realized it was going to rip the wing off and he was going to crash. So he killed the engine and stopped in the sand. The next model that they built was the real breakthrough. The next model that they built had a twisting wing. Not true ailerons in the fashion that we see them today, but the ability that when you turn the rudder, it also tilted the aileron surfaces of the wing so that the wing would tilt with the turn, and thereby you could keep the plane level. After announcing by telegraph to Paris that the Wright brothers had flown an airplane and it could stay in the air indefinitely, well, as long as the gasoline lasted, in disbelief, they said, bring the plane and show us. So they put it on a ship and they sailed to Paris, and they flew over Paris for 45 minutes. People stood on the ground with their jaws open as they flew around and around and around, making one controlled turn after another. And then they said, that's how it's done. And 60 years later, we landed on the moon. Where did Wilbur and Orville get the idea that they would jump from being bicycle mechanics to being the world's first to make controlled turns in the air in a heavier than aircraft? Did they bring that forward with them from another lifetime where they flew on a regular basis? Did they wake up in the middle of the night with their hearts jumping out of their chest? Wilbur, I got it figured out. Come on, let's go down to the bicycle shop. Orville, it's 1 o'clock in the morning. I know. Let's go. Get up. Let's go. Come on. You can hear them doing that. It's a drive, and you have that drive. You have that ability as well. Where does it come from? Give us a call. 415-762-1161. 415-762-1161. I know there aren't many of you out there tonight listening live. Most of you are going in tomorrow, and you'll be turning this on as you're working on your favorite project on your computer. That's fine, too. But if you're listening live, give us a call. Tell us what you think. I had some interesting email lately about Remembering the Future. The book, Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, is now out as an ebook. You can get it at rememberingthefuturebook.com, rememberingthefuturebook.com. Just click on the cover. It's only $7.95. You get the book with color photographs and drawings, actually. And you also get 25% off the printed version when it comes out in about 76 days. We'll send you a coupon code to your email that we get from the receipt of your purchase of the ebook, and you'll be sent an autographed copy of the printed version for 25% off. And I want you to share the word, because we're introducing this as an ebook as a special favor to you, because we don't have much time. It's 2010. We're a third of the way through the year. 2012 will be upon us before we know it. Somebody asked me the question this week, so, Dr. Agnew, how's that 2012 thing coming? I mean, is the world going to end in December of 2012? And I said, well, maybe it will and maybe it won't, but it certainly is going to be something cataclysmic and wonderful and perhaps terrible. And they said, so when is it going to happen again? I said, it's happening right now. In the last day, we had a mysterious eruption in Iceland that has sent volcanic ash and steam so high into the stratosphere that transcontinental flights that use the Arctic route have all been canceled. You do not want to fly a precision jet engine through volcanic ash at 55,000 feet. It's not good for the bearings. It has a tendency to chew up the compressors and eat away at the aluminum skin and the leading edges of the plane. Not a good thing to witness while you're looking out the passenger window. So, not to mention that there have been, in the last 90 days alone, several debilitating earthquakes. The number of earthquakes in 24 hours used to average between 15 and 20. Now we're up to 60 to 65. We used to get maybe one, sometimes three earthquakes over 5.0 on the Richter scale 3 years ago. Now we're getting 20, 25 over 5.0 on the Richter scale, and they are occurring in places like China and Haiti and Chile and Mexico. And now in Iceland we have another volcanic eruption. These cataclysms are increasing in frequency and increasing in intensity, which means we're ramping up to 2012. It is going to be a rapid succession of cataclysms, earthquakes, tidal waves, hurricanes. So I suggest that you get the ebook in your hands and get it read as quickly as you can. Learn the skills that are in this book. Learn how to use these patterns of observation and the ability to resonate with our planet and add your conscious intention to it in a scientific way to make things happen rather than watch them happen. Why don't you participate in the evolution of the human race and of the planet instead of just being a spectator? So that's why the book is an ebook, because we do not have much time. I don't want you to wait 76 days to read the book. I only need you to wait 76 days to buy the printed version. But you can have the words in your hands now, instantly, even though it might be 1 o'clock in the morning where you are, or 9:30, or 6:30 at night. You can buy the book anytime, 24 hours a day, because it's available as a download ebook, an electronic book, $7.95, and you get it in your hands and you'll be able to read it right away. The subject we're studying tonight is reincarnation. We come to this life with a latent, perhaps dormant toolbox. It takes a few years for the human brain to mature. The human brain, at least in my opinion, is a lens through which the consciousness can see into our dimension. It also is, you know, the computer that helps us figure out how to do things. It is the CPU of the biological transducer we call the human body, which is no slouch in itself. Even ones that aren't terrifically beautiful or athletic have tremendously developed olfactory spectrometers built into the head. We have chemical spectrometers built into an organ we call the tongue. We have the ability to sense a wide variety of frequencies all the way up to infrared with our fingers and our skin. We can hear sounds. We can see various spectra of light with our eyes. We're a walking, talking, measuring machine here. So we don't come into this life as a blank slate. We don't come into this life as an empty shell, and then all of a sudden this strange personality steps into it. Oh, not at all. This is a almost symbiotic relationship between a biological transducer and an animated spirit on the inside. But the spirit can feel nothing. The spirit cannot even taste chocolate. Come on. You need the body for that. So when one considers the idea of being reincarnated into a biological transducer, it's almost like, oh, wow, I don't want to have to go through that again. No, it's not quite like that. It's not like going through adolescence again, although you are. It is like, oh, you mean... I get to feel the wind through my hair again? You mean I get to feel what it's like to fall in love again? You mean I get to surf and I get to taste delicious coffees and I get to do all the things I love to do, ride horses, ride the waves, ride the wind, climb trees, walk through grass? I get to look up at the stars at night and wonder about this three-dimensional universe that sits here in obscurity. Yes, it means all of that. The very best of the best have come here. Some of the greatest souls in the entire universe have been here and lived lives here and will yet come here. Some of you are out there right now as children, as young adults, as perhaps misplaced or underused spirits, sitting there at your workstation drawing little lines for somebody or figuring out different spreadsheets for one business or another. Is that really who you are? Or can you not wait for quitting time so you can jump on the two wheels and go cruising through the mountains or put the top back on your car and feel what it's like to go through the air or to go home and pick up that musical instrument and do what you really love doing? That's what mortal life has to offer. That's why we keep coming back over and over again. If you go to the website, rememberingthefuturebook.com, one of the things you're going to notice is there are two portraits on the front page. One is of the author, moi, at age 17, and the other is a picture of moi at an undetermined age. I have to tell you, there's only a few minutes between those pictures. That's it. Just a few minutes. Yes, a lot has happened in that time. Four children have been born, raised, two of them married, lots and lots of life experience in those few minutes. And I've tried to savor every single second, half second, quarter second in those few minutes between those two photographs. But I'm here to tell you, folks, it's too short. If it was 100 years, it's a microsecond. If it was 1,000 years, it's only a few moments. If it was 1,000,000 years, it's barely a weekend. It's not long enough. Eternity is a flash of existence. And I think I know that we experience that as a mortal being many times, either on this world or other worlds. If you've had that feeling, if you've had that experience yourself, give us a call, 415-762-1161. And if we have existed on other worlds, and we reincarnated many times on those other worlds, as another sort of being, what did that being look like? What do you feel you looked like? Did you look like us? Did you look like something different? How did you accomplish? How high did you grow? How magnificent was your life there? What was the interaction between you and your planet, you and your society, you and other races which may have lived on your world? And why did you leave that world to come here? Now, it's often said that once you begin reincarnating on one world, you have to keep reincarnating to that world until that world no longer exists, until it passes away. Once it passes away, then, of course, you're freed up, and you can go to another world to live a mortal life. And then when you die there, you are continuously resurrected or reincarnated on that life. Now, the interesting thing is, when does it stop? Well, I guess my question would be, why would you want it to? I mean, would you think to yourself, okay, that's it. I've had enough misery for 100 lifetimes. There's no way I'm going through that ever again. So you're going to quit. You're going to say, it beat me. I'm not going to overcome it. It's overcome me. I am going to sit for eternity and sulk and pout. I'm sitting here on, don't ask me to play that. I'm not playing. I'm going to sit here on the cloud, and you guys can go do what you want to do. I'm done. I don't think so, people, because we don't remember pain. I believe that. We don't remember pain. Oh, it was real. We felt it. I hit my little finger on my left hand one time with a hammer. If I could feel it right now, I would. It was the most intense pain I ever felt in my life. And I was up on a wall and couldn't climb down, had to finish nailing the nail. If pain was remembered that well, the human race would be extinct, because women would only have one baby. Once they figured out it hurt like that, you can forget it, Bubba. No more kids for you. No, no. Pain is not remembered, people. Joy is remembered. Absolute joy. That we carry with us. That. However, you have to admit, you don't learn near as much from a success as you do a failure. Nobody goes out and tries something for the first time and boom, it's an instant success. Doesn't happen that way. Read the book, Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel. You'll see. It doesn't happen on the first try. It doesn't happen on the second try. But there is a resonance of those tries. There is a frequency of applying that intention over and over again on a single dream, the process of which will generate whatever it is you dream about, for good or for ill. So, you don't learn so much from success, but you do learn from failure, and you do learn, and then you have a success. So what do? Sit around and say, okay, guys, I finished the sandcastle. Here it is. Ain't it pretty? Okay, I'm still looking at it. It looks great. I really like the sandcastle. It's wonderful. Okay, what do we do now? Wonderful sandcastle here. Okay, I'm bored. Let's jump on it. Yeah, that's exactly what you do. When you do have that success, you climb up on top of it, get to your knees, put your hands down, push, stand up, and now you're standing on the success. And you're not going to look down, folks. You're going to look up. Where do we go from here? Excellent, excellent thoughts. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. Take a quick break. We'll listen to the Alice Band.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come, saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archers split the tree.
There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century.
Well, I was lying in a burned up basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky.
There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said, I was hoping it was a lie.
Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship fly in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one.
All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seat to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seat to a new home in the sun.
Welcome to the third hour of X Squared Radio. Our phone lines are open, 415-762-1161. You can also reach me through Skype as a chat. We do get a lot of chats during the program. I'm getting a steady stream of them tonight, but I can't go into the subject matter too much. I'm trying to read and do it at the same time. I can't do it. So what I really want to hear from you all is if you've had an experience that leads you to believe that maybe there's something to this. We are talking about the subject of reincarnation. We touch on it from time to time in this program. Not really a proponent of it one way or the other. I'm not trying to push it, but I am putting all of the possibilities out there. As a scientist, we always talk about possibilities. We know what the status quo is. We've read it our whole lives. We've had it preached to us from the pulpit for as long as we can remember. We already know that story. We already know the story that you get one lifetime. You possibly bring memories here from a spirit existence. Not really sure what that's like, but you know, it does say in Revelations that there was a war in heaven, and that I don't really know how angels fight, but evidently Michael the Archangel defeated Lucifer and his angels and thrust a third of the host of heaven out of heaven somewhere. I guess they came here. Some could be as many as 10 billion or 100 billion spirits, hard to say. Evidently, they never get physical bodies, so they just remain spirits forever. But we get to have spirits. We come here one time, get a lifetime, and if we get it right, well, I guess we can go on. If we get it wrong, well, that's okay. God's merciful. Everything will work out in the end. However, you know, mortal life, it's easy for those who cannot fill in all the gaps to say, well, it's a mystery. Think about it is okay. Worry about it, not really. Try to delve into the mystery of it, absolutely not. Stay away from it. There's nothing but deception there. Fear that, because if you don't live this life correctly, with fear and trembling before God, then you're going to spend eternity somewhere where you don't want to be. And, you know, if you adhere to that, that's fine too. If you feel that there is some motivation behind the leaders of various sects, whether it's Christian or whether it's Muslim or whether it's Hindu or Buddhist, to say otherwise, that's perfectly understandable, because at the end of the day, it's men and their philosophies that make up most churches. I'm not saying that there are not some restored gospels out there that have wonderful points to them, but even if you study the written part of the gospel, the written part of the scriptures left behind by the prophets of old, the jump between what they're trying to say, what they recorded about their wars and their genealogies and their relationships with God, and what you can do on a day-to-day basis, that gap is made up and by the philosophies of men and more current prognosticators and prophets and various pastors, priests, and whatever that interpret those scriptures for you to be able to use in your daily life. It's easy to read, and it's easy to reread, and you get something out of it every time you do read it. And if you want to call and talk about that, that's fine too. No problem whatsoever, as long as we try to approach it from a more scientific point of view, more evidentiary point of view, instead of just saying, well, if you don't believe, you know what's going to happen to you. No hatred, no fear, and we'll just try to listen to all stories. I also want to let you know that X Squared Radio is getting ready to make its debut and the broadcast area again. I say again because we have tried this a couple of times in various venues, but they have not been really legitimate efforts to access the airwaves. And this time I think we're with the right team, with the right crew. And I think in 20 weeks you're going to start seeing some syndication for X Squared Radio. And that's good. That's that comes from you. And we appreciate it more than you know. I know there aren't many internet listeners tonight. That's just sometimes the way it goes on internet radio. The weather gets really good. I know April 15th, for some very strange reason, the malls were absolutely packed. There wasn't a spare parking space. Don't really know what that's about, but as many cars were there on the 15th of April as there were during Christmas. Dale from New York, you're on line one. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Have you been keeping up with the program?
Yes, I have. And I'd like to relate a couple experiences I have, see what you think of them.
All right, go ahead.
Over 30 years ago, I was stationed in Berlin, Germany. At that time, it was still a divided city. And over the course of my time there, I visited a lot of places. And naturally, I had a girlfriend. And one day, we were driving on the Autobahn that kind of goes around the city proper, the western part. And in some places, there's still these flak towers that were built during the war. And they're so massive that it was just nearly impossible to destroy them or tear them down, so they basically built a highway over it and used it as a support structure. And as we were approaching one of these things one day, I had the most incredible deja vu that I could ever think of. Like, I knew this place for some reason.
Really?
And that has always stuck in my mind.
What did you find most familiar about it? What time of year was it?
I think it was around April. It was in the spring. It's just like I knew I'd been there, been inside this place. And I couldn't give you any specifics, but I knew I'd been in and around this thing at some other time. Of course, in this life, this is the first time I ever saw this structure.
What did you find so familiar about it? Was it a feeling? Was it the architecture? Was it the people that were there?
It was the architecture and the feeling that, like, the steel doors were still intact on there, that I had been through these doors and went up the corridors and went out onto the flak tower itself where the anti-aircraft gun would have been mounted. Yes, there's other places in the city I felt familiar with. I don't know why. It just one of those things. I spent 6 years there. And I felt very comfortable living there.
Did you go back to that place and just kind of sit and, meditate, as it were, or just sit quietly and see what you could pick up?
The way the highway is designed around it, it's almost impossible to get to it unless you take some footpath to it. But at that time, it was nearly impossible to get to it because they had incorporated it into the support system of the highway that went around the city.
Oh, I gotcha. Okay. Well, now you had one more experience.
We can't really get near it.
Did you have one more experience you said you wanted to relate?
Oh, yeah. It's the same situation. Actually, it's a little different. One morning my girlfriend at the time, we're having breakfast, and she says, "You know, you were speaking a strange language last night." I go, "What language?" She says, "It's not one I recognize. It wasn't German. It wasn't English. And it definitely wasn't any European language she's ever heard." And she was pretty well educated. And I don't think I've ever had a recurrence of that, but I found that kind of intriguing, you know.
Very interesting stuff.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
And I spent some time in my life researching reincarnation, and to me, it might give you a chance to achieve what the Christian ideal is, maybe, to perfect yourself. I can't see you doing it in one mere lifetime if you're lucky enough to live 70 years. and you survive all the things that come at you, and you don't do anything stupid, and you don't die prematurely. You know, I don't think 70 Earth years is enough time to figure out what's really going on, if you know what I mean.
And certainly only the very few get 70 years. I mean, come on. We have a whole country, a generation is under the age 24. They're all dead. You know, you don't get there are things that happen from disease to captivity to war. Natural disasters, all kinds of things cut life short. I mean, if there is a creator out there, I you may be right. I think, you know, reaching the Christian ideal of being able to reach perfection might take more than one try, might take more time. And besides, what's really wrong with that idea?
To me, there's nothing wrong with it. It actually, Christianity makes a little more sense if the reincarnation is added to it, as opposed to it being denied. You know what I'm saying here?
Well, I will tell you, because I have friends who were caretakers of some of the most ancient manuscripts from which the modern scriptures have deviated so sharply, and reincarnation was ensconced in those documents, all through them. It has been systematically expunged from the record.
Right, and if you want to exercise control over people, well, of course you're going to tell them, well, you only got one chance, you better do it our way.
Hmm. Well, interesting. I appreciate the call, Dale. Please call back
anytime.
Again. Fascinating stories.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Mark from Ohio, you're on line two. Welcome to the program.
Hey, Dr. Agnew, how are you tonight?
Hey, I'm doing wonderful. How are things up in Ohio?
Well, you know, they're pretty good right now. But I wanted to kind of digress here a little bit. I wanted to first bring up a few topics about reincarnation, and then I wanted to digress into some earth changes.
Okay, sure.
You know, the one story in the Bible that I really remember is where the scribes and the Pharisees asked John the Baptist, are you a Moses? Are you Elijah? Do you remember that?
Are you that prophet? Yes, I remember that exchange.
Do you think maybe the Pharisees were expecting Moses and Elijah to return?
Well, of course, yeah. They were expecting them to return. They really didn't know what John the Baptist was because he wouldn't say what he was. And they tried to get him into a trap because they knew that there were prophecies. Now, by the way, I have to tell you, those prophecies have been removed from the scripture. But the idea that the Pharisees were quoting a prophecy that used to be in the scripture that they read and they knew very well, that Elijah would return as a reincarnated being. And that's why they were quizzing John out, because many of the activities that John was participating in there around the River Jordan fit the profile of both of those individuals. And so the Pharisees, who not only believed in resurrection, but they also believed in reincarnation, came and quizzed him out. Who are you? Are you this person? Are you that person? And it was really strange. It's translated in English kind of funny, but it's really strange that they asked him if he was that prophet. Now, there have been prognosticators that said that prophet was the Christ. But if you remember, in the exchange, they asked him if he was the Christ, and he said no. So they'd already mentioned that person. So this that prophet person had to be another individual. Maybe was so powerful or so mysterious that they didn't even know his name, but they knew what he would be doing, and that would be restoring the original gospel.
So there was a scripture in the Old Testament that was removed that talked about reincarnation.
Yes. Absolutely, and it's in the old manuscripts. And in fact, if you go to the Torah, we had Rabbi Yossi on the program just a few weeks ago. You can go back and listen to the archive. And I asked him specifically about that. And he said, yes, absolutely. The idea of roving souls or reincarnated souls is definitely in the original Old Testament.
Well, that's very interesting. And you know that story that you told about the boy that used to be a pilot in World War II? I love that story. I first heard that on Coast to Coast. Were you reading from a book? And if so, could you tell me what the name of that book is?
Oh, yes, I'd be happy to. It was a book by Ian Lawton called The Little Book of the Soul. And it might have been Ian Lawton that read it on Coast to Coast. We've asked Ian to come on the program, but he is not doing interviews anymore. But he sent us the books personally, and it's fine that we read them and give him credit. So, yes, of course.
You know, Billy Meyer material talks about reincarnation, and they state that typically every 152 years, if a planet has a normal population, that a spirit will reincarnate into a body. However, in the case of overpopulated planets, the reincarnation cycle can be much shorter. I thought that was interesting. And another thing that is kind of interesting, goes along with what you're talking about before, about people coming from other planets. According to the Billy Meyer material, that Billy is actually from a race called the Lawsons, and the Plagiarans actually brought Billy to this planet in a spirit form so that he would reincarnate here, and that he'll have several more lifetimes on the Earth here, which I thought was interesting. But
yeah, that is interesting. That is interesting. I've read a little bit of the Billy Meyer story, and we've had a Michael Horn on this program a couple of times, and he's the official spokesman for the Billy Meyer story in the U.S. I find the story fascinating. I've heard the debunkers, and you know, I certainly respect them for their research, and I have a tendency to accept or reject information sometimes based on the energy with which it's delivered. If it's delivered with a lot of hatred and name calling, I have a tendency to back off a little bit. If it's delivered with an open mind and I can feel that the sincerity of the person who's giving it, then you know, I certainly give it more credulity. And I have to say that I've looked into a lot of the information that Billy Meyer has put forth, and I think a lot of it is credible.
Great. You know who else does great lectures? Randy Winters. I don't know if you've run across any of his lectures on YouTube or Google Video, but he really is extremely knowledgeable, and he preceded Michael Horn.
Ah.
Yeah.
And that's
he was Winter, over there.
Like
he
Winter
was over
the
there
race?
About the time that Wendell Stevens was over there.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, way back when. But I wanted to bring up something about Earth changes, and then I'll get off here. I don't want to take up your whole show. I ran into a guy named John R. Moore. Have you ever heard of him?
I have. Go ahead.
Oh, you have heard him. Well, that's interesting. I'd like to get your take on John.
Well, go ahead and tell me what the subject matter is, and then I'll tell you.
Okay. Well, this is... I ran across some of his material on YouTube, and he's a retired Special Forces guy and a police detective that has gone public with some information that he has supposedly learned from his military contacts. And according to John, the U.S. government knows full well that these coming abrupt weather changes and cataclysms are coming. And he describes a map that he got from a retired submarine commander that shows exactly what the U.S. will look like in the very near future. And the map is pretty interesting. The West Coast is not as bad as many people think. But San Diego and L.A. and San Francisco and Portland, Oregon will be underwater, but the water only goes in 50, maybe 100 miles. It's not as bad as some people thought. However, Washington State will be completely underwater. The western edge of Texas will be underwater. And really, what is really bad is the East Coast. And according to this map, all of Florida will be underwater. All of the eastern coast states will be completely submerged. The Great Lakes will become one large lake. Wisconsin will be completely engulfed by the Great Lakes. And the Mississippi River will be greatly expanded. In some places, it will be hundreds of miles wide. And so basically, the U.S. will be split into two countries, basically, right down the middle. And he really shook me up because he's in his mid-60s. He's straight-laced, white-haired guy, represents the establishment. He's not the kind of guy that would just pull things out of the air, if you know what I mean. So have you heard this guy before, you said?
Yeah, I have. And the map, what I'm trying to understand about it, and I'd like to get him on the program sometime. We have talked about the possibility of giant tsunamis, like 300, 400, 500 meters high, being driven by these rogue waves that right now are going parallel to the coast. If they begin to turn perpendicular to the coast, we're talking about storm surges that are barely subsonic, that just come in and wipe things right down to the sand. The idea that ocean levels are going to rise to the point that you have that kind of encroachment on dry land, it doesn't make a lot of sense. There isn't enough change in water level to do that. No, what has to happen is a change in land level.
Hmm.
That's what's going to change.
Interesting. You know,
and
here in Ohio,
this
winter we had some snowstorms that were not normal at all. I live about an hour east of Columbus, and the first storm this year dumped about 15 inches on us. The second storm came 3 days later, and we got about 8 inches. The final storm came a few days later, and we got another 6 inches. And the power was out here for about a week. I'm so thankful I did invest in a home generator about a year or so ago.
All right.
The thing that really strikes me about these weather changes is that these straight-line winds that we're getting are completely not normal. They come sometimes when there is no weather front associated with them. It's almost like the jet stream has descended to the surface of the planet. And I don't know how I immediately knew that this was wrong. It was just something deep inside me that just told me that these winds were just not normal. So
yeah,
maybe
I have seen that too. Living in North Carolina for a while, living in Kentucky for a while, and in Idaho, I have seen these straight-line winds come in, and it's just a perfectly calm day. Everything's fine. And either dust or just a straight-line rolling cloud, almost looks like a giant rolling pin in the sky, just comes across 60, 70, 80-mile-an-hour winds for about 2 to 3 minutes, and then it settles right back down again. But it'll rip the roofs off of barns and take tents and send them flying, and they don't show up on radar. They don't. They're not any part of a weather front. No change in temperature. It's very strange.
John did say that the U.S. Navy is sending all of its retirees to the Ozarks in Missouri and Arkansas. And I guess those are the quote-unquote safe lands.
Eastern Kentucky, eastern Tennessee up against the Appalachians, western North Carolina up against the eastern side of the Appalachians. Once you get up about 900 feet above sea level, the Appalachians are a very, very old mountain range, not very seismically active. And as far as on the East Coast, you really need to get inland quite a ways. Chesapeake, Virginia, Washington, D.C., Boston, certainly Florida, you're just talking a sandbar. I mean, if you're going to go have a look at the beach, go have a look at the beach, but by all means, move. All right? You're being given warnings that go back 500 years, and these are very highly in high engineering accomplishments by races of people that should not be considered primitive in the least. And now you have information, especially that John Moore is talking about, that does exist, that has been analyzed, and is being kept from the public. Hopefully, it'll be leaked well enough. Now, it doesn't have to come out on CNN, people. Will you just use your brains for a minute and your common sense for a minute? This information begins to leak out, and search your feelings. Find out if it's true or not. I mean, if it's one of these things that you just blow off like Y2K, you know, and you're going to say, well, my real estate values are going to hold no matter what. Fine. I, for one, am going to hang around the mountains and stay away from the coasts.
Do you think the winters for the northern part of the country are going to continue to get more and more intense?
Yes, they will. Glacier growth has been up now. Let's see, this is the fourth year that glaciers all over the world have been increasing in size. And now we've got enough time on them, enough winters on them, that we're now tracking the rate at which they're growing. But we're talking about Nordic glaciers. We're talking about Himalayan glaciers, American glaciers, South American glaciers, and in the Southern Hemisphere as well. All these glaciers are growing again.
Yeah, it's. I was hoping that we were going to be spared from this, but I think we're going to experience some of this. So anyway, I wanted to share that with you. I want to keep it positive, but
we're not going to be made extinct by it, because, you know, it's like having knowledge of the future doesn't mean that you're a victim of the future. You're empowered with knowledge, and you can make an informed decision now. You can decide for yourself whether you want to be a victim or a survivor, or whether you want to not just survive, but be so well prepared that you can lead when these things happen.
Well, thanks, Dr. Agnew. I appreciate talking to you as always, and have a very good day, and keep reminding us about these earth changes that are coming. It's always good to be reminded, and have a good evening.
All right. Thanks, Mark. Thanks for the phone call. All right, Earth Explorers, what we want to make sure, we started out covering the subject of reincarnation. What we want to make sure of here is that we're not getting in a religious battle with anybody. I know there are people out there that say, oh, you know, you're doing a great disservice, you know, God is in control of everything, and you only get one lifetime, and you better do it right, or, you know, you're gonna end up in big trouble. Well, you know, I don't know many people who become convinced that reincarnation is real, who squander a lifetime. In fact, I think that once they find out that mortal life is so important, that it is a design, it is a spiritual experience for a spirit to have a mortal experience, they treat it with even more reverence. And they're even more careful with it. And they take even greater care to love every single day. I don't see the same pattern of fear recycled into a system of belief with it. And I got to tell you something. When there's a spirit about something, that the fear goes away, that's always a good thing. I don't mean that you're going to go out there and stand on the beach unafraid and face a 400-meter wave traveling at 350 miles an hour. That's a little bit like suicide, I think. If you know these things are coming and you have it within your ability to say, look, we have plenty of time. Let's plan carefully. Let's sell our real estate. Let's get our assets together. Let's pay off our debts. Let's relocate to a safer area. Let's try to get our family to a safer area so that when these earth changes come and the world does look like these maps that John Moore is talking about, and like we talk about in the Arc of Millions of Years series, We talk about these earth changes. We talk about the way the United States, for instance, is going to look after the water settles. I, for one, would like to realize, or at least have some hope, that you have taken the information that we've provided you over these airwaves, you've taken it to heart, and you've taken some proactive action to be part of post-cataclysmic human race. I don't know what else to tell you. I mean, are you going to just live on the coast and watch it come, or are you going to move to the safer areas like New Mexico and the highlands of Arizona and maybe Utah and Colorado? Certainly these places will be safe areas. Let's find out. Mark from New Mexico, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Brooks. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing wonderful. How are things down there in Red Rock country?
Oh, it's just marvelous down here. I've had a very mild winter, and unlike many other places, and we're in close to 80 today and had a nice rain shower to water our new vegetables, and so it's been very nice today. It's beautiful.
There you go. These places that are more desert-like are becoming more tropical. I got to tell you, over here in eastern Kentucky and western North Carolina, we had a winter like no other. I mean, just
right.
more snow than has ever been recorded.
Yeah, and I have friends and family in New Jersey, and they were all complaining. I said, oh, it sounds like when I was a kid. I remember it being 3 feet of snow and went ice skating for 3 or 4 months of the year, and, you know, that has gone by the wayside, and it just came back. And it's, to me, it's what one reason I don't like to live in New Jersey. But I was calling to add to the conversation about reincarnation.
Oh, okay.
And as I don't believe too much of anything, and my reality is that it is a part of our journey, which is eternal. Of course, when we come in body, we forget this and have to spend a lifetime almost remembering that this isn't the only time around. Usually when we do that, as you were saying, we have the compassion and we realize that what we do makes a difference, and we don't squander it, as you say. And we come from a place of love again, and that's my reality. If I offend anyone, I'm truly sorry for that. But this is what I've come to know now. I'm in my mid-50s, and it's a beautiful way of understanding the world and seeing that we have another chance, if we so choose, to get it right, if that's what you want to say. But as far as I'm concerned, we do it right. Everything we do, is there's a reason for everything we do and for everything that happens to progress our spiritual selves.
Yeah, it's you know, the sandcastle of life. You build it, and then you get done. And then the idea is to keep building. The idea, the purpose, is to keep growing, is to keep learning. I don't know about you, but it would take several lifetimes just to learn the subject matter that's already on the Internet. And they're adding more every day. So there's a lot to learn out there. And you're never going to, well, it can be said you're never going to learn it all. But that's not really true. Eventually you will learn it all. That's just going to take several lifetimes to do.
And I've had near-death experience, and I've also had memories. I'll give you an example of one memory I assume from a past lifetime. There's a I live in New Mexico, and there's a pueblo here called Acoma, which is also known as Sky City. which is built on top of a mesa. And I had never been there before until just 2 years ago, I guess it was, or a little less. And as we were driving out there, I was invited to a festival, and we were driving out there, and we came around the corner where we could see it, and I had to pull over because tears came to my eyes. And what came out of my mouth was Masada. Now, I've never been to Israel. And I've heard of Masada, and I understand that it is also a mesa. But seeing a city people inhabiting the top of a mesa brought back a memory that I didn't have in this lifetime, that brought an emotional response. Now, where did that come from? Is it genetic? Well, I'm not Hebrew in my family. To me, this is just a response that, okay, well, at one time, you probably were in that neck of the woods, and you understood what Masada means. That is the type of I have those types of experiences quite a bit in different areas, but that one was very, very memorable because of almost turning into sobs. And I wear my emotions on my sleeve anyway. But
I can see that though. When you get into a place where whatever it is that has happened there before. The emotions, the presence that was there, makes contact with you in such a way that it really touches your heart. And then you get the feeling, you know what? It was probably me. I was here. I had those feelings. I can smell what it felt like here.
Right. So for me, that is a reality. It's not a belief. It's what it is. I mean, does that mean others are wrong? No. If they think this is one time around and you better do what you need to do, okay, great, do it. You know, I'm all for it. Each doing as they feel they need to do in this journey that we call life. And hopefully that they'll find their joy and their peace within while they're doing it, so that it's a joyful experience, because
the joyful experience.
Oh yes, yeah. Joy is our birthright if we choose it. So I hope we do choose it and do all we can to have joy in our lives and bring joy to others. Because as you said, pain is not remembered. I've written a blog about that myself, and you know, asking the question, what's the worst pain you ever had? You know, think about it. And you won't remember the pain. You'll remember the anxiety and wishing it was over and how scared you were and the fear of it, but the actual pain, not so much.
Yeah.
Because, as you said, we would go mad as beings if we did remember the actual physical pain. And
I'm completely with you, Mark. I got other people waiting. I really appreciate the call.
All right. Take care. Have a great night.
All right. Thanks, Mark. Bye-bye. Right. Scott, you're on line one. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Dr. Brooks. I suppose I should invest in a canoe or an inflatable mattress so that...
people down here in Florida. I don't know. I mean, I'm going to go down there a couple more times and then... Oh, my goodness.
I wanted to contribute to the reincarnation topic in that I have suspected other lifetimes, and when asking with my pendulum and so on and so forth, yes, certain countries pop up for me, South America, and the Sioux part of North America. We're going back thousands of years, perhaps. Some places in Europe, some places in southeastern Africa, Madagascar, Australia and Indonesia, and a few places in the Middle East. But the ones that I can verify in terms of experience aren't so much reincarnational but parallel universe experiences where I sense myself in another reality and in this reality at the same time while I was meditating. And the other reality was one that was rather gray and it seemed rather passionless. The sense was maybe I was living in America or a European city or something. It wasn't clear at the time, but that later in a reading I asked, I work with Galexis, and Galexis has had a program on BBS radio, and Galexis explained that was what was going on. It was a parallel universe where in that universe I would have gone crazy because I have so much passion in this one to be in a reality where there's no passion, that would be that would be enough to drive me crazy and just not to feel not productive in life at all. That would be I think a worse nightmare than being run over by a 300 foot wave going 300 miles per hour. But anyway, I just wanted to contribute that to the program in terms of my parallel life experience.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate it. I too, you know, don't like the passion. That's why I didn't be a molecular biologist. I just, all the guys that I hung around with there were just as dry as toast. So I said, I'm going to go over here and become a chemist. I'll see you guys later. you know, as a scientist, we are becoming more and more open-minded to a quantum way of thinking, which is, that is to say, we consider possibilities. Reality is just a combination of possibilities. Mixed with our intention and the average energy of everything that's poured into the set of energy that makes up the universe, the idea of a parallel universe is completely acceptable in science. It's also very well supported in the scriptures. The fact that there is a spirit realm right next to us in this physical realm, and that there is some war of principalities going on in it, is perfectly acceptable in the ecclesiastical world, and we in the more real world, shall I say, or in the physical world where we exist now, we have respect for that viewpoint. Although I don't see very many people whip around in the middle of the street and observe some battle going on between principalities behind him on the sidewalk. We do accept that those struggles, those oppositions, those mix of energies do exist. And whether we participate in that or whether we do not remains to be seen. But the idea that they exist isn't denied even by the religious world. So, you know, to say that you can tap into the experiences that your Scott self is having in a parallel universe ought to give you a great advantage in this universe, having that perspective.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Dr. Brooks.
You're very welcome. Be safe down there in Florida. Keep your eye on the horizon and a full tank of gas, my friend. It's a long way up I-95 or...
Well, I'm in Daytona. It only takes 2 hours to get to Jacksonville, and then I'm pretty much out of it. But I need to go on Highway 10, I guess, up 75, not 95 at that point.
Ah, okay, okay. Yeah, head for Atlanta.
Yes. Talk to you later.
All right, bye-bye. You know, as we discuss this subject matter, Earth Explorers, you get all kinds of opinions, and a lot of those opinions are built from the training that individuals have had as youth, whether they're in their religious environment, strictly religious, or whether they're in an a-religious or non-religious or mildly religious household, you're going to get some kind of yay or nay on reincarnation. But on this program, we just try to consider the evidence. It isn't that you know, we're trying to preach anything. We certainly don't do that. If anything, we're just preaching an open mind. What we're looking at is a preponderance of evidence which does not conflict with the original writings of any of the prophets. It's only the interpretations of those writings, the ruminations, or the rules and canon that has been laid down upon it centuries since those things have been written. And one can speculate as to why those things were written the way they were, why those rules were laid down, because, you know, we humans always take advantage of one thing or another. I fail to see what the advantage of reincarnation would be in trying to lay down the idea that we exist a lot longer than just one lifetime here, and that one lifetime, as fair and bountiful as it might be, is unfair. But as unfair, and I have to tell you, a third of the world has to walk for a day to get to a telephone. They don't have access to clean water. They don't have sewers. They don't eat on a regular basis. Their bodies are infested with parasites and terminal diseases. Their infant mortality rate precludes the survival of the human race. This is not the way that a spirit has a life on this planet. This is not a quality incarnation. To live on in this life, eating dust and swatting flies away from your eyelids, is not a fair mortality. It deserves another shot, as primitive as it might be. And that is just the compassion of a human. Can you imagine adding the compassion, the love, the infinite patience and planning of a God? And if there's a single God out there ruling over the entire universe and all the beings in it, his son came here to have a mortal life. And he wasn't treated well. He overcame it all. He is a pillar of heaven to go no more out. And yet, he will come again. So there you have it. We have about 6 minutes left in this broadcast on spring day in North Carolina. Watch the weather. Keep your eyes open. Look at the news. We will be sending out the newsletters on a more regular basis. We're putting in some of the kind of global warming news. You know, is the world warming? Is it cooling? We have evidence that all of the glaciers are growing. We have evidence of volcanic eruptions, earthquakes, tidal waves, all the world's disasters that we kind of keep track of. And it isn't that we're getting better at tracking them, it's that they are increasing in intensity and in frequency. The times leading up to Earth changes of 2012 are taking place almost like clockwork. Write down the Mayan calendar, write down the Hopi calendar, write down all of the ancient civilizations from which we gathered our information and put into our three books, the Ark of Millions of Years series. Those books are still out there, folks, and if you don't have a copy of them, many of you do, but if you don't have a copy of them, you can go to the ArkofMillionsOfYears.com, ArkofMillionsOfYears.com, just like Noah's Ark, and if you can't remember it, just go to Google and put in Ark of Millions of Years, or put in Brooks Agnew, or put in Hollow Earth, and you'll get to the books. One way or the other, you can find them. Get a copy of those books in your hands. If you order them from our website, you're going to get them autographed. You're going to get the first two volumes in audio version. So if you're not a great reader, don't worry about it. I read them for you, okay? There's about 1,500 pages there and all. Over 45 hours of reading. So you can go down the highway and listen to the book while you have it on your bookshelf and use it as reference material. Many colleges do. And the fourth book, which is called Remembering the Future, it's not part of the Ark of Millions of Years series, but it picks up on a discovery that I made while we were writing the books, and it deserved its own book with more in-depth study on how to work resonant energy, how to recognize it, how to meditate in a quick and easy way. We don't teach the meditation, but we describe the meditation in the book and give you plenty of access to teachers who do teach it. It's easy to learn. It's inexpensive. It's very practical in today's fast-paced world, and it does work. And we want you to learn it because you have to learn how to listen. Now, many of you do pray, but I have a feeling you lay down or you sit down or you kneel down and you do all the talking. Meditation teaches you how to listen. The talking is fine. Getting your intention out there is fine. Getting your inquiry or your pleadings before the Lord is out there is just fine. This just teaches you how to take the time to listen, because the answer is going to come very quiet. And if you're all noisy and all about yourself, you're not going to hear it. So just a little bit of advice. And we'll see you next week on X Squared Radio. You can now plan the rest of your week. And by the way, go to webtalk.net and catch us on that broadcast as well. We're a proud member of the BBS Radio Network, the largest and most listened to internet radio network in the world, and we will continue to be. Thank you for being here. Thank you for being part of X Squared Radio, and we'll see you next week. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.